Today, our speaker is Reverend Doug Traversa. Doug is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tullahoma. He completed his seminary studies at Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago. Doug is a retired Air Force officer, gamer, and dog lover. The title of Doug's sermon is A Farewell to Harms. Let's welcome our speaker, Doug Traversa.
First of all, I want to tell David, where's David? Is he out there? Best story I've heard ever since I've been coming here. I am getting that book for my granddaughters. I have three granddaughters, all very young, with my oldest son and his wife. And yesterday I went up to see them. And that book's perfect because we're fighting the perpetual battle of dad versus mom. Mom's got them. Bedrooms pink and purple and princess stuff, and dad's teaching them the important things, soccer and Star Wars. So yesterday, a friend of ours had given me six pictures from The Empire Strikes Back from her days of college and said, do you want these? And I said, I have granddaughters who need these. So I took them in there, and he immediately hung them up on the bunk bed, which has got a wooden side. And the oldest girl, who's only in kindergarten, says, I want some of those up on the wall on the top where I am. And he says, okay, which ones do you want? And she immediately walks over and points to Darth Vader. And I want Darth Vader. And he says to her, well, who's standing there with Darth Vader? And she goes, Boba Fett and a stormtrooper. And my heart just swelled with pride. And he does have them all playing soccer, too. So there's hope. So we got to get the anti-princess book out there and show that the girls can go out and make friends with dragons and not be locked upstairs where they're supposed to be according to societal norms. So, what was that one called? The Worst Princess? Okay. That's her Christmas gift. We talked in Joys and Concerns about the anniversary of 9/11. On 9/11, I was still in the Air Force, and I was teaching ROTC at UNC Charlotte. And so we have college students, freshmen through seniors in our cadre of cadets. And someone comes in and tells me, one of our sergeants who works up front in the office, and he says, somebody accidentally flew a plane into one of the Twin Towers. And at that point, that people were still thinking it was a small private plane and it was a terrible accident. And obviously, as things unfolded, we realized this was much more serious. I went out into a little lounge that the cadets had with a TV, and the news was on. And pretty much everything stopped at that point. And we're all just watching the news. And this is before the plane had been flown into the Pentagon. I believe that was the last one that hit. And we're watching this live. And the cadets are sitting around with me. And if it had become apparent, we were under attack. And I turned to them and I said, you need to pay very close attention right now. This is Pearl Harbor. This is how big this is right now. This is perhaps the biggest thing you're going to experience in your life, historically speaking. Pay close attention. I got a videotape, a VCR, popped it in there and started recording it. And I still have that to this day. And sure enough, the world has changed dramatically and is still suffering horrible repercussions from that day. And you, whether it's direct or indirect relationships, you can pin everything going on in the Middle East to that event. You can trace that out to the refugee crisis in Europe. You could even argue what's happened in Egypt and Libya, the balance of power in the world. Everything has been unhinged and changed by that event. The number of lives lost directly and indirectly tied to that are certainly in the hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions. It's hard to get an accurate count. And, of course, we can't simply limit that to the American lives lost, but the Afghan lives, the Iraqi lives, Syrian lives. And now it's still coming home to roost, even in modern politics in the U.S. in the current campaign. This has been an amazingly powerful and awful event in our history. And I just wanted to take a moment to speak on that. That's not the topic of my sermon, but it does somewhat tie in to the notion of harm. Harm that has been inflicted on individuals, and how we, outside of that person, need to think about what they perhaps have been through that we can't relate to or can't fully comprehend, and to not pass judgment on others for the pains they've suffered and perhaps their reaction being not what we think people need to do after they've suffered. So bear with me as I go through this, because I need to lay a little groundwork. And that first groundwork is that in America today, when someone has suffered, we really have a tendency as people to try to figure out why it happened. First of all, we don't want this notion that horrible, random things happen to people, that there has to be a reason. And there are at least four categories, there's probably more, but four that I came up with as I was working on this, of ways people help to ease their own discomfort with the terror of horrible events that might happen to them by coming up with explanations that perhaps make them feel safer. So here's four, and you can come up with others probably on your own. And if one of these touches you, I'm not attacking you, please don't take it that way, but I am rather saying, consider the implications if you hold this view and perhaps change a little bit to allow for others to have suffered and it not be their fault. Because a lot of this is about pinning blame on the victim. So the first one is, suffering is caused by you, yourself, because you have negative thoughts. Or you're not thinking about things the right way, or your thought frequency is incorrect. There's many different forms of this. One of the most popular ones in our country can be summed up, although not exclusively, by the teachings of the book The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. And I'm just going to quote from her book because this pretty much explains it. Often people recall events in history where masses of lives were lost, and they find it incomprehensible that so many people could have attracted themselves to this event. Because if something horrible happens to you in a situation where it happens to a lot of people together, according to the teaching of The Secret, you've attracted yourself there somehow. And she says people don't understand this. By the law of attraction, they had to be on the same frequency as the event. It doesn't necessarily mean that they thought of that exact event, but the frequency of their thoughts matched the frequency of the event. If people believe they can be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they have no control over other circumstances, these thoughts of fear, separation, and powerlessness, if persistent, can attract them to being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So in this view, if something bad happens to you, and it's a mass event, you have still attracted yourself to being there through your thoughts of fear, negativity, whatever. It's your fault. That is the underlying message of The Secret. Good things are your fault because you think properly and get on the right frequency. Bad things are your fault because the frequency of your mind is in a bad place. I give this zero credence myself. I'm sorry, I'll be blunt. It's blaming the victim. And even those who have great wealth showered upon them, I don't think it's the frequency. There's a lot of randomness, mistakes of birth, whatever, that can help people to have great wealth or great health, and it has nothing to do with the frequency of their minds. That's been my experience anyway. Another example, and one that you've probably heard of, is called the prosperity gospel. So now we're going to shift to the religious realm. It's very popular in many Christian circles, but I have to emphasize, this is a minority view within Christianity. Don't paint everyone with a big broad brush on this. But there are subsections of Christianity that teach something like this. This is a quote that's attributed to Joel Osteen. I can't swear that he said it. I did some research. I found a lot of websites that say he said it, but I couldn't find the original source. So maybe he didn't say it. I'll acknowledge that. But it does sum up the teaching, whoever said it. God wants us to prosper financially, to have plenty of money, to fulfill the destiny he has laid out for us. In this view, you simply need to claim the promises of God, and he must reward you. He's locked in because he said, if you claim these promises that I've given to you, then I must respond when you claim them. So God, in this particular view, has become a genie in a lamp, almost literally. And if you know how to rub the lamp properly, you will get your wishes. If you suffer, it's your own fault because you have rejected the promises of God. Again, blame the victim. It's your fault you weren't wise enough, smart enough, spiritual enough to do the right thing, so the suffering is your fault. Number three, you could call this spin doctoring. It's this notion that horrible things happen, but there's going to be a good result. There has to be. God is in control. He causes, and I keep saying he deliberately because those who hold these teachings think God is male for some reason. God causes all that happens to happen for a reason. And if you're a Christian or a follower of God or whatever term you want to use, these things are going to ultimately work out for the best. No matter how horrible it seems now, there will be a good result or a good reason. God will not test us beyond what we're able to bear. God causes good to come out of evil or suffering. Sometimes this suffering is simply a test, as in the story of Job in the Old Testament, or more accurately, the Hebrew Bible, in which God and Satan, who at this point at least are hanging out together, and Satan is sort of a advocate that sits next to God and challenges God's views on things. And God says, look at Job. What a great godly man. This guy has got it all together. No problems with Job. If only everyone were like Job. And Satan says, well, everything's rosy for Job. Let's test him a little and see what happens. Let's see if he still follows you and doesn't curse you. So through a series of horrible events, Job loses his flocks, his family is killed, he breaks out in horrible diseases and boils all over his body. Every horrible thing you can imagine, short of death, happens to Job. And it's all a giant poker game, essentially, between God and Satan. Let's see if Job folds or not. And at this point, you are just a pawn. But there's a reason. You know, God's making his point to Satan, and all the horrible things that happened to Job are part of that plan. And at the end, everything works out okay because Job gets a new family and new flocks. And the ones who died, I have never understood that part of the story. He doesn't raise them from the dead. He gets a new family. And so all those people died for God to make his point to Satan. And then finally, there's also the secular approach, since I'm not just up here bashing those who have views that blame the victim from a religious perspective. Secularists do it also. Some of the phrases you may have heard are things like, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, or no pain, no gain, or quit whining and get over it, and quit your damn belly aching, or whatever. It's like, okay, something bad's happened to you, now pick yourself up and move on. But you can't always do that. And we have to acknowledge that. And we see that a lot. And we see that a lot in politics, too. The poor and oppressed have become footballs for the two parties to play with and argue about why they're poor and oppressed and how they should be treated and how the government should treat them. And there is certainly a great number of people who just say, well, it's their own fault. Why should we help them? And in some cases, it is their fault. You know, there's not 100% answer to anything. But in many cases, it's not. And a refusal to acknowledge that is really the root of the problem. Another approach to all of this can be the view described by Stanley Kubrick, the famous movie director. He writes, or has said and has been written about, The most terrifying fact about the universe is not that it is hostile, but that it is indifferent. But if we can come to terms with this indifference, then our existence as a species can have genuine meaning. However vast the darkness, we must supply our own light. Now, I find this view most appealing or most reasonable, most likely, but that's just my perspective, because I really do think the universe as a whole is indifferent. We're here by a happy accident, perhaps. Don't know, don't claim to know, but from my ability to understand the world that I'm in, if something good or bad happens, it may well be beyond my control, and indeed probably is in many cases, and I have to accept that that is part of what it is to live in this universe. And even though that may make you think the universe is a very dark place, no, it's a place whereby we can supply the light to help others, to band together, to try to make sense of this, and to support each other. And when we do that, we aren't dwelling in darkness anymore. So the universe may be indifferent, but that does not mean there is no meaning and no purpose as we go through it. I want to share a portion of an article now from Free Inquiry magazine from February-March of this year by Edward Tavish. And the reason I want to share this story is I think it wonderfully illustrates and tragically illustrates that sometimes horrible things happen to you, you have no control over them, and they leave a mark that never goes away. And imagine telling the woman in this story that she brought this on herself because she didn't trust the promises of God, her brain wasn't on the right frequency, or she just needs to get over it, or that God will still bring good out of it. Those four perspectives I talked about. Now, this man's mother was in a concentration camp, and he didn't find out until he was much older that one of the most horrific things that happened to her was she was in charge of taking a roll call every morning, and one day she gave a miscount. And so she had counted one person less than there should have been, and the Germans laughed at her, and they pulled out her best friend in front of her and shot her. And so now the number's right. Remember this every time you do the roll call. Now that's just one of who knows how many hellish things happened to her in a concentration camp. And it becomes to me not only frivolous and silly, but downright insulting to say, well, it's too bad you attracted that to yourself with your brain frequency. Or, I know it's really bad, but you just need to get over it. Sometimes you're broken. And that's what I'm talking about today. To let people be broken instead of demanding they conform to our ideas of recovery. When I was 4, my mother brought me into the kitchen and said in a matter-of-fact way, "Do you see that oven where I bake things? My daddy and brother, who were your grandfather and uncle, were burned in an oven by Nazis. Just a few years ago." He was 4 years old. The same year, she came into my room one day, shouting in her native Hungarian, which I couldn't understand. She hid me under the bed, telling me in English that German soldiers were coming and she didn't want them to find me. Later, when my father came home, he asked me what I did during the day. I told him we played a game about German soldiers and described what had happened. He turned pale and said, "Son, that wasn't a game." But I remember telling him, "Yeah, it was a game. There were no real soldiers." And he gave me the perfect answer for a 4-year-old. When we sleep, we have dreams. Sometimes mommy has dreams when she's awake. Too bad her brain frequency was off. God. The next incident occurred on Halloween when I was 6. I didn't go trick-or-treating. Instead, my mother dressed me up in a costume to greet the kids when they came to our door. What a costume it was. To this day, I still don't know where she got the outfit. She refused to ever tell me. Somehow, she was able to cobble together a Gestapo costume, complete with a toy German Luger, boots, and a swastika armband. I didn't understand the full significance of what I was wearing, but I was amused by the shock reception I received from the kids, and particularly their parents, when I opened the door. My mother was suffering from what was later called Stockholm Syndrome, in which captives begin to identify with their captors. When my father came home and saw me in this outfit, he screamed at her. She calmly responded that she was just planning for the future. She said that when the Nazis took over here in America, I would be able to pass for one of them, and I would not be killed, unlike the fate that would befall both of them. My father whisked me into another room and tearfully apologized for leaving me in the care of such a crazy mother. Sorry, I get a little bit emotional about this. And of course, as I said, we're trying to take a look at these different arguments. He was writing this article as part of a greater theme of why is there evil in a universe if God is good? And he's countering this argument that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, that God has a plan for everyone. Being in Auschwitz provided no benefit to my mother. She did not emerge with greater courage, resilience, strength, or willpower. If God wanted her to develop any of these qualities, she could have been placed in a boot camp instead of a concentration camp. Now, stories of great suffering and horrible evil are abundant in our world. This is just one example. But by using this story, I ask you to think, how do you deal with such horrible suffering in a person's life? Suffering that marks them forever. And they can't just get over it. Do we, deep down inside, want to find a reason to blame them? You know, why didn't the Jews all just take up weapons and fight the Nazis? Well, they tried. In some respects, they tried. Read about the Warsaw Uprising sometime. It's easy to say things like that if you're not there. Why didn't they just become Christians and trust God to save them? That's hardly worth responding to. Why didn't they get their brain frequency right? Well, the secret hadn't been written yet, so sorry. No, and you certainly don't tell his mother, just get over it. I don't think she can get over it. And I don't know that she's still alive now, but sometimes you just don't get over things. How do we respond in those situations? Now, I'm not saying that there's no benefit to having a positive outlook, to trying to make the best of a bad situation. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not making any claims about God or whether there is one or not. Not the point of this story. I'm not saying there aren't people who do need to get over it, and some people who could get over something and choose not to for whatever reason. Those things happen too. Everything is not black and white. Everything doesn't fall into one of two neat categories. So please don't go out of here thinking I'm saying that. What I'm saying is life's very complicated. Based on my observations, terrible things happen to people. It's not their fault, and this happens all the time. And it's not up to us to try to figure it out or blame somebody or say, well, if only you had been a little more careful or been a little wiser, this horrible thing wouldn't have happened to you. That's not our place. Can we, interact with people who've had great tragedies in their lives and simply let them be where they are at that point? To let someone be broken, to be their friend, to support them, without demanding that they conform to your idea of recovery. That's what struck me as I was reading this story about Mr. Tavish's mother and what formed the idea for this sermon. Can we let people just be, and can we incorporate this into our philosophy, our theology, our ethics, whatever it is that drives us to live the way we do? I hope Unitarian Universalism challenges you to wrestle with questions like this, because we don't have pronouncements from on high, be it from God or from the Unitarian Universalist Association from bishops and priests and popes or any other religious hierarchy. We don't have them coming down and telling us all the answers. Rather, we are encouraged to examine the whole range of moral and ethical teachings of humanity. We are allowed to look at multiple religious views and philosophic views. We are encouraged to do that because life is complex and it doesn't come down to one neat little book of answers. And the other thing is, all of this, this wrestling with these tough questions requires work. It entails thought. It entails interactions with other ways of thinking than our own and constant evaluation of what we hold dear. And I certainly hope in the end we can find room for those whose lives have been broken by suffering and evil, allow them to be blameless in their suffering rather than trying to quiet our own fears by figuring out why it happened and why it's really their fault. So therefore, we can avoid this suffering if we just don't make the same dumb mistake. That's really what drives, I think, a lot of this. I come back to Stanley Kubrick's quote, "The most terrifying fact about the universe is not that it's hostile, but that it is indifferent. But if we can come to terms with this indifference, then our existence as a species can have genuine meaning. However vast the darkness, we must supply our own light." Now, whether or not you agree that the universe is indifferent, the notion of supplying our own light, I think, could probably resonate with almost everyone here, if not all of you. I think that part of the light that we can bring to this world is a clear-headed understanding that when people suffer hardships, we must allow that bad things can happen to good people. Or, if you don't like this dualistic notion of good versus bad, simply show compassion and empathy for someone who is suffering or who has suffered, and avoid the temptation to blame them so that we can construct in our minds a safe world where random acts of harm don't happen. It may not be comforting, but the universe may well be indifferent to you. That makes our church community all that more important. I'm sorry I used the word church, the fellowship, the congregation. For those who are not comfortable with church, I write this for my congregation and we still have church on the sign. The thing is, when we come here, you can really use the metaphor of light in that whatever it is we're going through in our personal lives, when we come here, I hope you feel like you're bringing a light here, that we're all bringing a light here, and that we can help each other when the universe seems scary. Right now, we live in a really scary world. It's always uplifting to be here with you, to be with my congregation, or any other one that I visit. And I hope that this talk and our discussion in the next hour will help us to find room in our hearts to stop trying to put people into molds who've had a really hard time of it and just let them be who they are and be a friend to them, not judge them, not mold them, not blame them. And through this, perhaps, to some degree, we can say a farewell to harms. Thank you.